Hello, and welcome to The Lancet Oncology in Conversation With. It's July 2024, and I'm Allie Landman, the deputy editor. Today, I'm joined by Professor Hisham Mahana, Chair of Head and Neck Surgery and Director of the Institute of Head and Neck Studies and Education at the Institute of Cancer and Genomic Sciences at the University of Birmingham in the UK, and Dr. Sue Yam, Professor of Head and Neck Cancer Radiation Oncology at the University of California in San Francisco, and Editor-in-Chief of the Red Journal, to discuss their series on head and neck cancer consensus recommendations. This four-paper series covers diagnostic recommendations for extranodal extension in head and neck cancer, as well as endpoint definitions in clinical trials for curative intent treatment and advanced and metastatic disease.
So welcome, Sue. Welcome, Hisham. So I'd like to get started by asking you to tell us about the landscape of head and neck squamous cell cancer and why it is so important to improve standardization of diagnosis and trial design right now in this disease.
The landscape of head and neck cancer has been changing in the last couple of decades, and we've had a lot more cancers that are driven by the human papillomavirus, HPV. Really, in some jurisdictions, it's almost what people call a pandemic or an epidemic. On the other hand, HPV negative head and neck cancer has been stable, or in fact, in some cases, reducing because of decrease in smoking and the prevalence of smoking. So the actual landscape, the epidemiology has changed over the last two decades. Now, in terms of the treatment landscape, for the recurrent metastatic head and neck cancer, there have been improvements in outcomes with the introduction of immunotherapy, but that's still limited to a small percentage of patients. In the locally advanced head and neck cancer, HPV head and neck cancer, as we know, has got much better outcomes than HPV negative head and neck cancer. And so people have been doing de-escalation trials, but we've now had almost two decades of de-escalation trials that haven't really worked. And we want to know, you know, what's the next step with that? How do we improve outcomes? How do we improve functional outcomes whilst still maintaining the really good survival outcomes? There's also discussions and exploration of the role of transoral surgery in the treatment of head and neck cancer. And then in the HPV negative side of things, there haven't been any new treatments for decades, really. It's almost 3.5-4 decades of the same treatments. And so we really do need better paradigms, more personalization there, especially since their outcomes are really quite poor, you know, 50% 3-year survival. So really very poor outcomes. Why is it important to standardized trial design? Well, really, one, so that we can compare results and interpret them better. We want to also make sure that the design is more robust, and so that, you know, the outcomes that come out are meaningful and can be implemented quickly so that we can change patients' lives. And part of the drive to improve trial design is actually the standardization of diagnoses, which determine eligibility criteria. So again, you know, feeding into the more robust trials. And it also has a real important impact on the standardization of clinical practice and the management and outcomes in clinical practice, whether it's, you know, a factor that is already being used, like extranodal extension on pathology, or a factor that is creeping into routine use, like extranodal extension on imaging. We saw the same happen with HPV diagnosis. You know, we had a myriad of tests, and then we started accepting P16 as a surrogate test with a specific cutoff and definitions. And then in the last year, the Head and Neck Cancer International Group published the EPIC study, actually in Lancet Oncology, and that showed that there was an important refinement to the diagnosis of HPV head and neck cancer, you know, which had been a question for 20 years and was now elucidated. So all that feeds into better trials, better standardization, feed into better outcomes for the patients and better ability to implement those studies quickly.
And I'd agree with all of those points, which are wonderfully accurate. We know that science depends on the accuracy of measurement, and progress will not be possible without standardization. And that's why it's critical that the way patients are diagnosed, the way that they're managed in trials, the way that we conduct the procedures in the trials is consistent from experiment to experiment. And I say that because each trial is essentially an experiment, and we can't compare the results of one experiment to another experiment if the conditions were not held the same. And that is just a fundamental principle of science. And then the other thing I would say, just to add further to the very illuminating comments, is that in addition to the importance of making progress and all these different clinical scenarios that we've known about, head and neck cancer is breaking down into more and more subsets. We're becoming much more specific. We understand the natural history of disease by subsite much more clearly, and we really can't test those together anymore. So for instance, oral cavity or larynx or oral oropharynx have to be tested separately now. And then within oropharynx, we have the specific categorizations of HPV or other molecular biomarkers that are emerging, which may subset that disease even further. And if you add in the other condition that we have a growing elderly population who may not be eligible for the same kind of therapies, what you have is a lot of different smaller subsets of what was once a very large heterogeneous population that was tested. And we need to be able to understand how trials apply to those different subsets. So it's really critical that we standardize procedures so that we're more easily able to collaborate across geographies, across national borders, across regions. We can test these very specific populations as in collaboration. And to do that, we need standardized procedures.
Thank you both for those insights. Those give a really great context for us to be able to dive now into the four papers of the series. So I think we'll start with the diagnosis papers. So detection of extranodal extension in head and neck cancer has important prognostic implications and can influence treatment decisions. And radiological detection of extranodal extension is a relatively new diagnostic procedure, and there is no guidance or common criteria on which to base diagnostic decisions. So Hisham, you have used a 5-round Delphi process to generate expert consensus recommendations on the terminology and diagnostic criteria for imaging detected extranodal extension. What are the most important recommendations and main takeaways of this work?
I think the really important takeaway from the paper as a overall is that we managed to bring consensus to what was a very disparate field. And, with lots of definitions for what is essentially the same thing, but lots of published definitions and so on. And that was the main aim of the paper, is to bring that consensus internationally right across the piece with the leading clinical trials groups so that we're using the same definition and the same criteria. Specifically, the most important, finding of the paper is this agreement on the criteria for diagnosis of extranodal extension on imaging, what we call IENE. And those were, that there was clear, irregular or distinct margins of the lymph nodes, the clear extension into the perinodal fat, the conglomerate or coalescent matted nodes was another important criteria for diagnosis, and involvement of adjacent tissues or structures like skin, muscle, and glands. Those four criteria were there was very strong agreement from all experts that these were criteria for diagnosis. What was also important was the criteria or factors that were not diagnostic of extranodal extension: central necrosis, thickening of the capsule. On their own, they weren't considered diagnostic of extranodal extension. Another important factor that was brought out was the effect of core biopsies on the interpretation of the imaging. So it's important for people to know whether a core biopsy has just been done on the lymph nodes, because that can affect the interpretation of IENE. There was really strong agreement between the experts on the importance of using, or the benefits of using, a classification system and of synoptic reporting, standardized reporting of the findings. And we then put to the experts three of the commonly used and widely published classification systems. There wasn't agreement. So we used the work from the consensus process to, and the criteria that I've just mentioned, to put together a new classification system, the HNCIG classification system. We put it back to the experts with the other three classifications, and there was strong agreement on using the HNCIG classification. So again, that I think is an important finding, in that the experts now have strong agreement on using one classification system, which will be a really important move forward. And then finally, we put together an atlas of examples of the different criteria to help people with, you know, the interpretation and essentially the training. And I think the atlas is a really valuable addition to the paper. So those were our main, you know, kind of the main take home messages from the process and from the findings of the paper.
Thanks, Hisham. So that great atlas of examples, that's available online, right?
It is. So there's a link within the article that takes you to the HNCIG website, and you can download it. And we're planning on making it a live document. So, you know, as we get more examples, we'll add them. You know, already some of the colleagues have taken a preview, have said, this is great. Can we get some examples of the pitfalls? So we're going to try to, you know, get some examples of the pitfalls added to the atlas. So, and I think it's a really great addition.
That's wonderful. That'll be a really great educational resource and a way to sort of keep the consensus going as the field changes, as new things, new diagnostics, new imaging is developed. That's great. Thank you. So let's turn to the second paper, the second diagnostic paper in the series, which talks about histopathological detection of extranodal extension, which is a well-known marker for poor prognosis. Now, unlike radiological detection, guidance does exist for use of this marker in staging and treatment decisions. So what was the ambition of the Delphi consensus in this diagnostic area, and what were the main recommendations?
You're absolutely right that extranodal extension on pathology, you know, is a recognized, very well recognized prognostic factor, and has been used for many years, almost now 20 years in clinical practice. And there are lots of guidelines, but that's the problem. Lots of guidelines. They're usually, you know, local or regional or national guidelines, and we were surprised at the differences between the guidelines. They're usually discordance in the details, you know. So, for example, same criteria apply for HPV positive extranodal extension on pathology as they do for HPV negative, for example? Or the discordance could be in actually omission of, for example, stating that the reporting criteria, some use more than 2 millimeters, some use an exact dimension, some don't, you know, mention it at all, or say don't report the dimension. So there was a lot of discordance in some of the details. So our primary aim here was really, again, to get consensus internationally amongst as many clinical trial groups as possible to achieve that standardization that we've just talked about. Both in the diagnostic criteria, but also in the reporting criteria. What do you report and how do you report it? But what we also found was that we helped define PENE better, and we helped elucidate the pitfall situations much better. And again, with a really very valuable atlas that clarifies those pitfalls very, very well. I'm not a pathologist, and I learned a lot from that atlas, I have to say. And it was really illuminating how my pathology colleagues kept telling me, you know, but it's not easy to determine PE and E. It's not as simple as I thought. It's, you know, you'll see it on the slide, you'll measure it. What's the problem? And then I saw 17 different examples of 17 different pitfalls. Very clearly, even to a non-pathologist, so clear how, you know, actually, you know, the dimension is not that easy to measure, because when you don't have a capsule, you might not be able to measure. Where do you start measuring from? As simple as that. Things are like, so that was the aim for us with the PENE consensus. And again, you know, we got endorsement from, I think it's 18 different clinical trials groups from across the world. So I think that's a major step forward as well.
Thanks so much. Yes, I agree. That's a huge achievement, I think, to get international consensus. And you've clearly outlined why that's so important, when all these details can differ, and you're not going to be able to compare outcomes for patients or even patients themselves if people don't have the same criteria. So thank you. So now I think we'll move on to the other two papers in this series, which are about trial endpoints. And I'm going to ask Sue about these. So we know that clear endpoint definitions are crucial for understanding the outcomes of clinical trials for all cancers. It seems, however, that for head and neck cancer, endpoint definitions are really badly poor standardization across trials, which can result in difficulty interpreting the results from these trials and putting them into practice. So could you tell us about the types of heterogeneity you found when you assessed endpoint definitions in phase 3 and practice-changing trials of curative intent treatment in early disease and in trials of metastatic disease?
Yeah, thanks for that great question. When we first started out looking at this work, we knew that there had been earlier literature that had indicated that the endpoints of trials in the head and neck cancer space were very heterogeneous. And so that was known going into the project. But what we hoped was that perhaps things had changed, that perhaps those papers had made a difference, and that current trials might look more aligned. And unfortunately, what we found was that wasn't so much the case, and that the trials still contained quite a bit of differences, both in the definitions and the composition of the endpoints. And so these articles assessed a large body of practice-changing or phase 3 trials, as you said, that were published from 1978 to 2004. And we amassed a fairly large database, essentially, where we broke down each endpoint from each trial and looked at how it was defined and what the components were that made up that endpoint. For example, events and how those were defined, or death and how that death was defined. And what we found, again, was that this was very heterogeneous across the different trials, even though you would think that in these large, essentially practice-changing trials, which is what we were aiming at, that they would be somewhat standardized, and that they would be, importantly, that they would be standardized because they are so critical in determining what we do in clinical practice. But what we found was that the actual endpoint that was named or even used in the studies, its definition, meaning the components that were used to create that endpoint or comprise that endpoint, and then furthermore, and importantly, the methods of assessment that were used to obtain those different components was very different amongst the different trials. For example, I'll just give you a very basic couple examples. Overall survival is assumed to be the gold standard of all clinical endpoints, and that's because we know that it can be fairly easily assessed and pretty easily understood, and it's considered to be the most free of bias. But I will just say it was only explicitly defined with a definition meaning death from any cause in most cases. In 100% of the recurrent metastatic trials, it was defined, but it was only specifically defined or described in about half of the curative intent trials. And while that seems like a relatively minor omission for such a well-known endpoint, it's important because we have to state that this is actually death from any cause and make that very clear so that when people are enacting that trial on the ground, who may have different levels of experience or different understanding or in the future are trying to interpret that trial, that they will know that that was the definition that was used and that was consistent with all other trials. And this is an important basis for things like meta-analysis, for example, because you really want to know in very clear terms and specific terms that the endpoints were stable among the different trials that you're assembling together. And I'll give you a more complex example, for example, something like progression-free survival. So progression-free survival in some cases was required to be confirmed by pathology, but in others was not. In some cases, it might allow for a planned neck dissection, but in other cases might not. Or in some cases, PFS required certain specific assessments that were timed at some given clinical event in the trial, such as some amount of time after completion of treatment, or it might not. Or it might include things such as specific assessments that were designed to rule out distant recurrence or second primary tumor, or it might not. And so, you know, we all know that when you look for something, you're more likely to find it. And so if certain assessments are required or not required in the trial, that can really change how that endpoint is comprised and reported. So those were some of the things that we found in terms of the types of heterogeneity, both in recurrent metastatic disease, but also in curative intent clinical trials. And what we're hoping is just by showing and demonstrating that this heterogeneity continues to the current day, that we can begin to understand this and make progress on this as a global community.
That's great. Thanks, Sue. I mean, you talk about such a fundamental concept of making sure not only that the endpoints are defined, and that's something that's really important that we spend a lot of time on at The Lancet Oncology, making sure endpoints and outcomes are defined so that people can really use and understand what's happening to these patients and how they were analyzed. Also that it needs to be, you know, if we're going to talk about the same thing, if we're going to talk about survival, we need to know that we're really talking about the same idea. So it's such a fundamental and important concept.
That's exactly right. And when you think about the tremendous effort that is expended on clinical trials and the amount of resources that we're putting into these clinical trials and the wonderful good intentions of investigators who design and conduct these trials, it seems like this is a important thing to sort of straighten out and get right at the beginning so that those efforts are going to the maximum degree possible to make the maximum progress possible, given our increasingly limited resources.
So your papers don't make any explicit recommendations for improving trial design and reporting for head and neck cancer trials, but what do you think are the key actions that need to be taken next? And I think you've already mentioned a few already, but.
Right. So great question. Thank you. We do understand that it may not be possible to explicitly standardize endpoints because, for one thing, there are different clinical scenarios that may demand a custom-made endpoint or a very particular kind of endpoint. There may be limitations on resources within that geography or culture that make certain methods of assessment possible or not possible or allow certain kinds of reporting. That we understand that. The other thing is that you just have different practice patterns and insurance coverage across different countries, or, you know, if it's not insurance, government coverage across different countries, and different kinds of assessments and procedures may be allowed. Even the number of follow-up visits may or may not be constrained depending on the healthcare system. So given all of that, it's just not possible to standardize endpoints completely across the globe in every trial, in every jurisdiction. And then, you know, we understand that different investigators have different goals when they're conducting a trial. There are practice-changing trials that are conducted at single institutions as well as large organizations, as well as internationally or by corporate sponsors. And these all have different capacities and resources. So that's one important point. The second point is that we did have our statistician authors review the different definitions of the endpoints, and talk about what they thought the implications were and what was feasible or not feasible from a statistical standpoint. So there's also a sort of a technical aspect to how endpoints are composed and what's proper to do or not do in terms of your procedures and how you manage the events and censoring and competing risks, for example. But leaving all of that complexity aside, what we can recommend and what we did in the papers is that investigators try to adhere to some basic best practices to make the endpoints as very clear and explicitly described. For example, just to quote a few things from the papers, so it should start as soon as possible after randomization of the start date, or it should be described very clearly if there is a variance from that. And you can imagine that if the timing of the endpoint is allowed to start as much as 2 weeks or a month after treatment, that can be very significant, particularly in the recurrent metastatic space where we're talking, particularly in the recurrent and metastatic space where the difference in survival can be on the matter of months. And then the other thing is what we count as an event, this is very important, and the timing of assessments and procedures for handling competing risks or censoring, we feel should be as clearly described as possible. And while we know that may not be possible to describe all of that in the paper itself, because there, you know, are word limits and just for readability, at least those can be described in supplemental appendices or at some place within the, you know, within at least within the protocol. So what's counted as an event and the timing of assessments and procedures for handling competing risks or censoring should be clearly described, we feel. And we also feel that instructions on how to handle equivocal changes or situations could be described. And while we know it may not be possible to describe that in the paper itself because of word limits or just for readability, it could still be described in appendices or at least in the protocol itself, because what we found was that these things were not necessarily even described when we obtained the actual raw protocols. And then I guess the last thing I would say is that with increased transparency, this is really important for the future. And so at least what someone should be able to do is look back at your study and say, okay, I understand how this endpoint was derived. I understand exactly what was done and what went into it. And I can choose to duplicate or not duplicate these procedures exactly with my trial that is testing a very similar question, or I can make explicit why I am not following those same procedures as this practice-changing seminal trial. And so that would just add to the ability to analyze data, to make progress. And then, like I said, when we start to compile results of trials together in meta-analysis, I think this would help a lot with understanding whether the endpoints are still stable, you know, between, you know, stable trial to trial. And that's a really, really critical thing in the view of our statisticians. And then I will just say that the HNCIG, which is an international group, head and neck cancer international group, that we many of the thought leaders in head and neck cancer around the world work with, we are embarking on projects to try to develop better templates that lay out some of what we think are the critical components of basic endpoints. That is an ongoing project that we've just begun. But this was the basic baseline data that we needed to be able to understand and start the project and get a sense of its scope.
That was excellent. Thank you. So now I'd like to turn to both of you and ask a broader question about your thoughts on how this work will change practice in head and neck cancer. And you've talked about this a bit already, but perhaps you could expand here, and also what the future research priorities are for head and neck cancer. So Hisham, why don't you start?
Sure. So I think all the work that is going to come out in the series is about bringing more standardization. And that standardization is not only in clinical trials, but also will bring standardization to clinical practice. I'm going to give you an example. The AJCC that does the TNM staging manual is already exploring incorporating extranodal extension on imaging into the next TNM staging manual. And they're looking to use the HNCIG definitions and classification as the criteria and definitions for diagnosing IENE if that goes into the TNM staging. So that in itself will have massive impact right across the world, because it's bringing one set of criteria, one set of classifications to be used, rather than, you know, the previous system was, for example, PENE is part of the classification system already, but there isn't a unified diagnosis or classification system that is being recommended. So that is just an example of how that work or, you know, one example of those of how that work can translate into clinical practice and into clinical trials.
I just like to echo that work has been really wonderful, because I think that extranodal extension is something that has really been a sort of a bugaboo, with people just not really having a precise way to define it. And so I think that's going to be a tremendous contribution, just in terms of getting people on the basic same page. And I'll say, you know, my own center, we're very excited to start using these definitions. And there's been some work that shows that the more that you train people on a specific definition, the more convergent the determinations become. And determination of E&E is becoming a very critical issue within head and neck cancer, I would argue more so in this decade than ever before. So I'm really looking forward to that work. And then in terms of the endpoints, I think what, again, like we were saying, I'm really hoping that the transparency will allow us to start to think about how we're able to collaborate better, and how we can make our trials speak to each other in a more logical and sequential way across the different jurisdictions or countries. And one important goal, of course, would be that we would love to see groups able to collaborate around the world. And if we can get some of the large groups or large corporate supporters to standardize endpoints, it might be possible to start to think about collaborative trials across groups or in different configurations that would allow us to actually answer questions faster.
And that brings us on to kind of the priorities in head and neck cancer research. And we talked about some of the priorities in the specific areas at the start of this podcast, but just looking at things on a global scale or a high level scale, we need better quality research. And we need to be able to do that, we need more standardization. We need better powered studies, which leads us on to the issue of the importance of better and wider collaboration that Sue was talking about. And you can only do that if you've got standardized protocols, standardized methodology, etc. And also, we need more personalized, more, you know, characterized, segmented groups. The issue that Sue was talking about earlier is, or at the beginning of this podcast, is that, you know, we can't take head and neck cancer as head and neck cancer as they used to be done before. We can't even now say HPV positive and HPV negative head and neck cancer. It needs to be more characterized. It needs to be more segmented. And if we're going to do that, to be able to give more personalized treatments, then again, we need the standardization, but also the collaboration. And, you know, that brings me on to what the Head and Neck Cancer International Group is all about. It's a collaborative of 24 clinical trials groups right across the world, from the US all the way to Japan. And we've come together to improve the standardization of clinical trials, of methodology, of clinical practice, and to also do international studies. So as Sue was saying, to be able to recruit quicker, faster, and more efficiently to these more segmented studies or more segmented populations. So I guess from a kind of high level point of view, those are the overall priorities, I think, for head and neck cancer. And then we can, you know, we've delved into some of the more specific things for HPV positive versus negative versus recurrent metastatic.
I'd also add that one of the important functions of this work, as I think Hisham had briefly alluded to very early on, is training and training the next generation in how we can improve our trial methodology, how we can communicate better as a community, and essentially how we can really focus and work together to make progress. And I think setting that kind of example is really, really important. And just being willing to point out the flaws in the work that we ourselves have produced is a really important admission and a really important teaching moment for the next generation of trialists. And the other thing I just wanted to say was thank you so much to Lancet Oncology for highlighting head and neck cancer, which is a disease that has really significant morbidity and remains, for the most part, with relatively poor outcomes for the majority of patients. And our group is so grateful to be able to publish these papers, both to just standardize things around the world and our community a little bit better, but also, like I said, to just show that example and demonstrate our willingness to make progress.
Well, thank you, Sue. It's our privilege to publish such high quality work. So thank you for submitting it. I think that's a great note to end on. I want to say that it's been a pleasure speaking to you both and hearing your insights. And thanks so much for joining me today.
You can read the series on head and neck cancer consensus recommendations online now at thelancet.com. Thank you to Dr. Mahana and Dr. Yam, and thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the Lancet Oncology podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts.